Good afternoon, brethren. It's great to be here. Brethren, what if you were in the wilderness and you had no concept of time? You had no watch. There's no lights, no city visible. So you, and when it's dark, you go to sleep. And you wake up at about midnight. But you don't have a watch. You think it's, well, it must be about 4 a.m. Well, I'm thinking if you do that, you must be over 50 and you're waking up when you need to be sleeping. But you know, you wake up and you think, well, the sun will be up here shortly. It doesn't come up. It doesn't come up because, you know, you think it's 4 a.m. and it's midnight. Do you doubt the sun will come up because it's not coming up when you think? No, you just know it's not time for the sun to come up. You have faith that it will rise. Yes, I'm going to speak on faith too. That sly dog, that Hudson, I think he has my house bugged. And he insisted on going first. That was... No, he didn't. He gave me the option. You know, I want to read from a book review, but don't get excited. My wife's already told me if I do another book reading sermon that she's walking out. That probably everybody will follow her. They'll all go to the break room until I'm finished. No, but I just wanted to read some here, if you'll bear with me. Book review by Ralph Levy. It begins, it says, the lieutenant's face turned beet red. He said, "You must be mad, Private," he bellowed. "This is the German army. This battalion's going to war. And you want Saturday off?" Under his breath, he spat out, "It's just my luck to be saddled with a religious nut." So reacted the commanding officer of Franz Hazel, a 40-year-old draftee into the Nazi German army during the Second World War, who insisted on holding on to his faith. Despite threats and dangers, Hazel was a devout member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and he held firmly to keeping the Sabbath throughout the war, with the exception of a brief period toward the end of the fighting when he lost track of time. He also held firm in keeping the dietary laws, refusing to eat pork throughout the campaign. I thought that was an amazing story. This book was written by his daughter, Susan Hazel Monday. I believe it was published in 2001. But, you know, he probably, as Mr. Hudson was saying, I bet that faith didn't come overnight. He was baptized in 1921, so I don't know how many years, whether he was reared in the Seventh-day Adventist Church or how many years he practiced that, but I doubt it came immediately. You know, faith is a building process that's built in different circumstances at different times. You just don't start at the top. As I've been told, the only profession that you start at the top in, and most of us wouldn't want it, is post-hole digging. So, you know, you don't start at the top with faith either. Well, let's look at lessons to be learned from men of faith. Let's like to look at Abraham first in Genesis chapter 12. Let's look at verse 1. And it says in Genesis 12, verse 1, "Now the Eternal had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house to the land that I will show you." It's the same applies to us. When God calls us, we must move spiritually. And he moved physically. And in verse 4 it says, "So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him." So he had faith in what God said, that God meant it, and God would be with him. In verse 11, "But look, he had faith to pack up, leave his home, and go to a strange country." And some of us wouldn't have that much faith. But then in verse 11, "It came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, 'Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, this is my wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live.'" In verse 13, "Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you." Abraham had faith to pack up and leave, not knowing where he was going, but he faltered when it came, "Hey, these people may kill me." And he told a lie is a lie. I guess she was his half-sister, but she was his wife. But he didn't have the faith, it seems to me, to say, "Well, God's going to protect me. So what? I don't have to fear the Egyptians." But he feared the Egyptians. And yet, and if you just look in chapter 15 and verse 5, Abraham. And God said, "Then he brought him outside and said, 'Look now toward heaven and count the stars if you are able to number them.' And he said to him, 'So shall your descendants be.'" And it says in verse 6, "And he believed the Eternal, and he counted it to him for righteousness." God said, "Look, you're going to have thousands, millions of descendants." And it says, Abraham believed him. And he was counted as righteous for that. But then look in verse 16. In verse 1, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children." He was promised thousands and millions of descendants, and yet there was no children being born. "And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, 'See now, the Eternal has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her.' And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarai." So this isn't happening. We've got to figure out some way to make it happen, even though God said it would happen. "Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. And after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went in," in verse 4, "he went into Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes." See, Abraham had faith, but there was times and circumstances when he needed to build more faith. There was times when Abraham, the faithful, I feel that maybe faltered at times. And he was still in a building process of having perfect faith. And trusting God, as we've heard, to answer that prayer according to God's will. Faith is built different times in different ways. Let's look at Elijah, the prophet, in 1 Kings chapter 18. See, a man of faith, and God answered many prayers of Elijah. Powerful intervention that would make most anyone believe. In 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 32, and this is the incident where Elijah was saying, "Who are you going to serve, Baal or God?" And all the priests of Baal were gathered at Mount Carmel, and Elijah, and he said, "Let's test and see who God is." And we have to understand the prophets of Baal. Haley's handbook said that they were the official murderers of little children. And they've excavated a temple in that area from the priests of Baal, which apparently his wife was Ashtaroth, and it was actually her temple. And they've excavated and found pots with little babies left in them where they were sacrificed. And so you see what Elijah was dealing with there, the kind of people. Well, anyway, in verse 32, "Then with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Eternal, and he made a trench around the altar, large enough to hold 2 sais of seed." I don't know what's, I think it's like 3 or 4 bushel. I don't know for sure. And verse 33, "And he put the wood in order, cut the bull in pieces, and laid it on the wood, and said, 'Fill 4 water pots with water.'" Maybe these were about 8 gallons apiece. "And pour it on the burnt sacrifice and on the wood." Then he said, "Do it a second time." And they did it. And he said, "Do it a third time." And they did it. So the water ran all around the altar. And he also filled the trench with water. He had faith. He was going to call upon God. "So the water ran all around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. And it came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, 'Eternal God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things by your word. Hear me, O Eternal, hear me, that this people may know that you are the Eternal God, and that you have turned their hearts back to you again.'" Then in verse 38, "Then the fire of the Eternal fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice, the wood, the stones, the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell down their faces, and they said, 'The Eternal, he is God. The Eternal, he is God.'" Verse 40, "And Elijah said to them, 'Seize the prophets of Baal, and do not let one of them escape.' So they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook of Kishron and executed them there." So they were certainly deserving of execution. And he was filled with faith. Filled with faith. And a great miracle was performed right before his very eyes. Then look in chapter 19, in verse 1. And of course, Ahab, who was king then, told Jezebel, his wife, that Elijah, all that Elijah had done. Also, he had executed all the prophets with the sword. In verse 2, "Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, 'So let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow, about this time. She's telling him, you killed my prophets, and tomorrow you're going to be as dead as they are. When he saw that, he arose and ran for his life. He had just witnessed a tremendous miracle of faith, and it seemed like he had total confidence in faith. He soaked the sacrifice just to demonstrate to these people that there is nothing that God cannot do. And when Jezebel threatens him, he runs for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he prayed that he might die and said, it was enough. Now, Eternal, take my life, for I'm no better than my father's. So you think he went from a time of being so exalted and feeling so powerful to the bottom. Have you ever been there? I think probably everyone has. According to your faith, Christ said. And in verse 10 of chapter 19, he said, I have been very zealous for the eternal God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. So it looked like it was all gloom and doom. As far as Elijah could see now, he was the last. He was the last of God's people. And he was discouraged, and it seems his faith was gone. But then in verse 18, we see what God says. Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So Elijah could not see what was going on behind the scenes. And his faith was being tried. But then God intervened and said, look, there's 7,000 that are like you and have not given up. We don't know how God is working things out. When we're praying to God, and no matter how desperate we are, we don't know how God is working that things out. I'd like to do another quote from the book. Francis' wife, Helen, also witnessed her share of miracles. Chapter 7 recounts how she was summoned into the dreaded Brown House, the Nazi Party headquarters in Frankfurt. The situation looked bleak. She was accused of refusing to join the Nazi Party, illegally keeping her children out of school on Saturdays. And I think there's brethren that face this in the world right now, every day, maybe in Europe and in some other countries. And writing a subversive letter to her husband. To make matters worse, her state financial benefits had been cut off, and she was suspected of being a Jew. She didn't have a whole lot looking good at that time. Helen put her fate in God's hands. She expected to see Herr Springer, a dreaded and cruel Nazi official. It says, God gave her favor during the interview, resulting in her benefits being restored and all harassment being ended. But it wasn't Herr Springer after all. You see, you don't know when you're facing something what God is doing behind the scenes. She had no idea. She was expecting to see someone that everyone dreaded. But it wasn't Herr Springer, after all. He had coincidentally taken ill that morning and had been temporarily replaced by another Nazi officer who happened to have close friends that were Adventist. I thought that was a demonstration that, when it all looks, it really is looking bad. You don't know what God is doing. And apparently, maybe she was ready to face whatever. But she stood by her beliefs, whatever that would have brought her. And God worked it out for her. I mean, it's amazing to me that somebody could be in Germany all during the war with the Nazi Party and get through it this way. I mean, how many would have that kind of faith? Let's look at Peter. We know that he told Christ he'd leave all, and then he ended up denying Christ. But then he was filled with God's Spirit, and he did tremendous things. In Acts chapter 3, in verse 3, and Peter and John were going into the temple, and there's a lame man who, seeing Peter and John about to go into the temple, asked for alms. And fixing his eyes on him with John, Peter said, "Look at us." So he gave them attention, expecting to receive something from them. Not expecting to be healed. He just expected to receive something like every day. Give me a quarter or whatever people would give him. So he gave them his attention, expecting to receive something from them. Then Peter said, "Silver and gold I do not have, but what I do have I give you. In the name of Jesus of Nazareth, rise up and walk." And he took him by the right hand and lifted him up, and immediately his feet and ankle bones received strength. What a miracle! Right, performed right before Peter's eyes, and this got the attention of many. And of course, God had a purpose in performing this miracle at this time. We always have to keep that in mind. It wasn't to exalt Peter completely, although God did want to demonstrate who he was working through. In chapter 4 of Acts, in verse 18, it's here where they commanded them not to speak or teach in the name of Jesus Christ. But Peter and John answered and said to them, "Whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you more than to God, for we cannot speak the things which we have seen. We cannot but speak the things for which we have seen." In other words, he's saying, are we going to obey you? Are going to obey God. And in Acts chapter 9, in verse 40, and the account of Dorcas. I remember when my kids used to call people, talk about dorks, say, "Hey, I don't know where that came from, but that may be evil. Let's not get into the dork thing." I mean, here's Dorcas. But Peter put them all out and knelt down and prayed. And turning to the body, he said, or no, this is Tabitha. I'm on the wrong lady. I got dorked out there. Turning to the body, he said, "Tabitha, arise." And she opened her eyes. And when she saw Peter, she sat up. But here's a dead woman. Had every indication of being dead, and was raised in a great miracle at Peter's prayer. Let's look at Galatians chapter 2. We see that even Peter, the great Peter, had times when he succumbed to his own nature or whatever it might be. Galatians chapter 2 and verse 11. Paul said, "But when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face, because he was to be blamed. For before certain men came from James," in other words, before the men came from James from Jerusalem, "he would eat with the Gentiles, but when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision." Peer pressure was greater than the rulers at that time who were threatening not to preach. He told them, "We're going to obey God rather than you." And yet peer pressure he would succumb to. Faith is tried at different times in different ways, because God is perfecting the saints. And of course we have David. You know, David goes and faces Goliath. David killed a lion and a bear. And he knew that God, he said, God delivered the bear and the lion, and he will deliver this uncircumcised Gentile to me. And he met this giant in the name of the Eternal. Yet later, David stumbled at times in faith. A man after God's own heart. You know, in 1 Chronicles 21, I might turn 1 Chronicles 21. It says, 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 1, says, "Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel." So it seems at that time that David moved away from faith in God, and he looked to these numbers. How many soldiers can I muster? How much power do I have here? And you might say, well, that was only a wise thing to do. But notice it says Satan stood up. And of course, this was like Satan stood up against Job. God was behind the scenes allowing this. But it seems he moved away from God. And he started looking to numbers, just as may happen to us. We may be very strong in one situation, and we walk out and think, well, I have this mastered. And something will come from a direction unexpected, at a time unexpected. And we find that we may lack faith. Had David forgotten the story of Gideon? Let's look in Judges chapter 7. Judges chapter 7. We see that Gideon was going to go up against the army of the Midians, and he just had too many people. He had too big an army. In Judges chapter 7, verse 2, "And the Eternal said to Gideon, 'The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into your hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, My own hand has saved me.'" God doesn't want us to trust in our own selves. And sometimes that can be a trial of faith. He said, "You have too many people here." Now therefore, in verse 3, "proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, Whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead. And 22,000 of the people returned, and 10,000 remained." So he had 30,000. Now he only has 10,000. He's only got 10%. In verse 4, "And the Eternal said to Gideon, 'The people are still too many.' And he was going to face an army of far greater numbers. Bring them down. And we know the story of the lapping of the water. And that in verse 6, and the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. Then in verse 7, then the Eternal said to Gideon, by 300 men who have lapped, I will save you. Yes, God used men, but at what? He used 1% of what it looked like was needed. And the 30,000 might not have been enough. He said, I'll save you with 300. We don't need 30,000. 300's enough. But you know, from the beginning, Gideon needed faith and encouragement. Just look back in chapter 6 when God, in chapter 6 of Judges, in verse 36. Then Gideon said to God, this, of course, prior to what we just read, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor, and if there is dew on the fleece only, and is dry on the ground, then I will know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. In other words, Gideon was a little shaky there, but he had faith in God. He communicated with God, and he was showing that he needed a boost. He needed a little help. You know, show me. And it was so when he arose early in the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. And the ground was dry. Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me, and let me speak just once more. Sounds like Abraham when God was going to destroy Sodom. You know, Abraham said, well, are you going to destroy it for 40, for 30? And he said, well, don't be angry, but let me speak again. Would you do it for 20? And so on. He says, do not be angry with me, and let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, but let the ground, let there be dew. And God did this. He was building him up, step at a time in faith. And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. See, Gideon, he had a big task, and there was a big trial he was facing. And he needed God to carry him through it and to give him a boost through it. And now back to chapter 7 of Judges in verse 9. That again, it seems like Gideon needed a little more encouragement. And I think David knew this story. I would be pretty positive that he would. Maybe he didn't. And it happened on the same night that the Eternal said to him, arise and go down. Now he's only had 300 men, where he had 30,000. Go against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. Notice verse 10. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Parah, your servant. In other words, God said, now if you're afraid to make this step, then do this. And you shall hear what they say, and afterwards your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with his servant to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east were lying in the valley, as numerous as locusts, and their camels without number, as the sand of the seashore in multitude. This was a tremendous task. And if you were facing that, you definitely would need a lot of encouragement and faith. And when Gideon had come, There was a man telling a dream to his companion. He said, "I have just had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of the Midian. It came to a tent, struck it so that it fell and overturned, and the tent collapsed." Then his companion answered and said, "This is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. For into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp." In verse 15, "And so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped, he returned to the camp of Israel and said, 'Arise, for the Eternal has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand.'" And God recorded all these people so that we could do the same thing and realize that we have to take the steps in building the faith that's required for salvation. Gideon needed encouragement, and God is with us in the same way. And we have to make some steps, but he's behind the scenes for us. And, you know, Mr. Hudson read from the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, the example of men in faith that died in faith, and God was with them. I thought an interesting little interesting story in the, I'm sure most of you probably have read it, in the December 2004 United News. About they're adults now, a couple of married people, grew up in the church, and they were reminiscing about when Christmas came at school. And, you know, the teachers, everybody's got to draw a Christmas scene. And so this girl, she remembered that she would draw something else, a snowman. And the teacher would take and put the pictures out in the hall. There would be 24 Santa Clauses and reindeers and one snowman. I mean, everybody knew who the snowman was from. She says in here, "When my daughter drew the snowman, she did it out of obedience to her parents." As Mr. Hudson brought out, we got to make the step in obedience, of course. And a belief that this is what God would want her to do. Her snowman drawing was evidence of her faith. But that was, you know, such a short little article. You could say by no one. Nancy Morgan, who's that? I don't know. And yet, a big lesson there that I thought, you know, demonstrates how we have to take those steps. I would like to read one more time. Do not be angry with me. Let me speak one more time, if you would. I want to read one more time. Is my wife still here? Yeah, okay. At the end of the war, liberated by Americans, so Hazel survived the war, keeping the Sabbath in the Nazi German army. Hazel appeared before an American colonel who inquired why there was a notation on his record that he was to be court-martialed after the war. They didn't want to get rid of the guy, you know, but after the war, we're going to get you because we need every gun right now. Apparently, this man didn't have a problem with killing other people, but he would keep the Sabbath because that's where his faith was. I don't know if he actually killed anybody. Who knows? But he was going to be court-martialed after the war. Hazel told him he had refused an order to go into battle on the Sabbath. You imagine being in a war? Well, this is Saturday. I'm going to have to lay down my arms, and I don't know what they did with him, you know. But they tolerated him somehow. The American colonel marveled. He was a Jew, or he was Jewish, but not a Sabbath keeper. get this, because it's too difficult, he told the German. It was too difficult for the American colonel. You know, I thought that was an amazing story. I called a couple of Seventh-day Adventist churches inquiring about this book. And, you know, they never heard of it. And I was amazed. I mean, one of their members, about their members, and this isn't that old a book, and they never heard of it. I would think they would have that book in every church and have it to give away, to sell, or do something with it, and they never heard of it. Of course, I didn't call every church, but I would think, you know, I didn't have time. Well, brethren, my point about that is let's not forget our examples of men of faith, as apparently it seems they have, and the lessons that they teach us.